most important thing for us as Americans, that our, you know, the reason people love America, the reason what makes us America, what makes us grow, what makes every single young man in pretty much every underdeveloped country want to come to the United States, what makes, you know, what makes it the number one destination for dreamers, and you know, and dreamers, people who dream of the life, of the best life. The reason for it is because we don't distinct between, you know, between any race or nationality or religion. And that is important. And that is also an important basis for other countries to cooperate with us. As in Iraq and Iran, whether we like it or not, you know, we do have mutual goals, and we have to work with those people no matter how much we hate or like them.
Ladies and gentlemen, the fact is, there is no Muslim ban. Once again, this is sensationalism and fake news by the media and the progressive agenda of the radical left. You are listening to OPSEC Radio on the America Out Loud Radio Network. We are going to talk about immigration and extreme vetting and the risks of placing politics above the United States national security. First of all, any nation not only has a right, but they have a responsibility to define their nation by enforcing their sovereign territory and their borders. Not only is that a right, it's a responsibility of a democratically elected leader to secure the borders, period. Once again, we have elements of society like Deep Pockets, George Soros, and other similar organizations that have their open borders agenda, aside from other agendas, which ultimately are going to lead to the downfall of the United States. We're not just looking at this in terms of bad guys or terrorists or even illegal immigrants flooding our borders. It's economically unfeasible. It's economically unsustainable. Therefore, our elected leadership, in this case President Trump, has a responsibility to the American people to defend these borders, to enforce our immigration policies, and to institute immigration policies. Donald Trump is working from the Obama established list of the seven countries. There is no Muslim ban. There is no Muslim ban. The most populous Muslim countries in Southeast Asia, specifically Indonesia, and then we have Malaysia and Bangladesh, and then there's Nigeria. Afghanistan is not on the list, and it goes on and on and on. But the fact to portray this as a Muslim ban, one would be illegal. And again, it's fake news. It's sensationalism at its best and opportunities to resist the President of the United States and using, again, fake news or this created, falsely created Muslim ban as their rallying cry. And again, it's progressive elements of the radical left that are flooding the airports, flooding the courthouses. This is tiresome. And we're only a week into his presidency. This is really tiresome. Not only is it tiresome, it's troublesome. It's a reflection of the demographics of the United States of America, same country that I defended for over 30 years. God almighty, what's happening? So let's back up here for a moment and examine the facts. Yeah, facts. Those are indisputable things, not the fake news that's created by some of the media. So first of all, nobody has an inalienable right to enter the United States on a whim, okay? It's a privilege to come to the United States. It's a privilege, and there's a legal process to go through. Now, as far as the green card holders, I think that there were some flawed policies that were instituted as part of this temporary process. There are there are bound to be some issues. And this was the whole point of the thing, was to put the brakes on for 90 days and to figure out what's wrong with the system, how do we fix it, how do we keep America safe. And in the process, you identify some problems, and the ban on the green card people, that's one of them, and that if it hasn't been corrected already, it will be. Next, there is no ban on Muslims. Hello, there is no ban on Muslims. There's a ban on immigrants from certain countries. That's it. That's it. No ban on Muslims, people. Open your ears. Open your eyes. Sorry if it doesn't fit your agenda of fascist Donald Trump, but there is no ban on Muslims. Next, the Constitution of the United States gives the President of the United States great authority, great flexibility in determining immigration policy. Why is it so surprising to everybody that Donald Trump actually followed through on a campaign promise to reform immigration? Oh my God, a politician that's doing what he campaigned on and promised he would do. How about that for a change? The list that President Trump was working off of is the same list that was established by President Barack Obama. Imagine that. Okay, so these seven countries are war-torn countries that have tremendous population of terrorists, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, not to say that they couldn't come from other Islamic states, and they have, but these are predominantly the ones, okay, and the threat is not Muslims, the threat is radical extremism. So why would we place a ban on Canada or Fiji? Because the terrorists aren't coming from there. Radical Islamicists are coming from these seven countries. You want to call it profiling? Call it profiling. The Israelis do it, and guess what? It works. It's effective. If you're looking for a black male, why would you screen white females? Okay? It's simple common sense. There's nothing racist about it. It's common sense. It's logical. This is a temporary ban. This is something that has been done historically throughout the history of the United States during World War II and the years prior to it. There was a ban on immigrants from certain countries, Germany and Japan. These people were subject to extreme vetting. I don't know what they called it back then, but it was extreme vetting. The United States is not against refugees, and it's not against Muslims. We have instituted policies that put a temporary ban on immigrants from seven nations. It just happens that they happen to be Muslim countries, all right? So get off this whole thing about a ban on Muslims, because it's fake news. It just doesn't exist. And by the way, President Obama did the same thing back in 2011. Nobody seems to remember that or talk about it or want to talk about it because it doesn't fit their agenda. Furthermore, ISIS has openly stated that this is part of their strategy to use the tremendous influx of refugees from the Middle East to infiltrate Islamic terrorists into the United States. So to ignore that would be irresponsible and foolish. Ladies and gentlemen, this whole policy is threat-based. It's not religious-based. It's not based on ethnicity. It's based on the threat. And the fact that the threat happens to be those not who are Muslim, but who are radical Islamic terrorists, radical Muslim. Nobody wants to make a distinction about that. You know, I hear the left talk about people stereotyping and casting a wide net. That's what they do when it comes to the right. They don't make a distinction between Muslims and radical Islamicists or radical Muslims. They want the right to group everybody together so it fits their racist agenda. All right? It doesn't work that way, folks. You may want it to, but it doesn't. Now, when I first heard about this whole episode and all the drama, the first thing I had heard was that there was a group of people detained that were Iraqi interpreters. As it turns out, there were only two of them. But and that really annoyed me because, one, over the years I've worked with interpreters from a wide variety of countries, and in retrospect, most all of them were Muslim. The majority certainly were. Now, back in 1950, we have a thing called the Lodge Act, also the Lodge-Philbin Act. What the Lodge Act did was basically establish a fast track for citizenship from individuals from what we call the Eastern Bloc, primarily, but that's what it was targeted for. But people from Eastern Europe that were allowed to immigrate to the United States. My former father-in-law was one of them that came from Czechoslovakia. People fleeing communism. And I was in 10th Special Forces Group, which was the very first unit once Special Forces was established, because they wanted the Russians to think that there were 9 other groups. But 10th Group was built upon the backs of Lodge Act people that had come in from Central and Eastern Europe and other places. But they had a knowledge, they had a familiarity with the culture, the customs, the language, the territory. They spoke the language. Why not extend the Lodge Act into the 21st century? Why don't we have a fast track for citizenship to these people that worked with the United States at great personal risk to their own safety, to their own life? I had an interpreter that had called me from Michigan and said, "Mr. Jamie, do you remember me?" And I recognize the name. And I'm trying to think. And I said, what contract was this? Thinking that I had employed him at one point. Turns out he was a teenage boy that was my interpreter in the refugee camps along the Turkish-Iraqi border. He was a Kurd. He had since immigrated to the United States, gotten his U.S. citizenship, received a security clearance, and was looking for work. When I finally made the connection, I was shocked. But here's a classic example of how this system works, how it should work. Here's a guy, or a gal in many cases, but an individual that has proven themselves, that has been vetted overseas by U.S. forces, been checked out through counterintelligence channels, and through their own actions have demonstrated their worthiness, their loyalty. These are the people that should be fast-tracked for immigration. These are the people that we want to bring back to the United States and reward them with U.S. citizenship for selfless acts that they performed in service of this country. What's wrong with that? And for that matter, let's look at the oppressed minorities in these countries. And again, in the Middle East, who are the oppressed minorities? There's so few Jews left anymore. There's so few Christians left anymore. But there are some. And then there's the Yazidis, the other ethnic groups. If we're going to grant refugee status, why don't we look at these folks? And certainly there are Muslim refugees. Part of the problem is that these individuals come from failed nation states, where these states are either our enemies and are not willing to cooperate, or the governments are in such abysmal shape, there are no records, there are no ways to substantiate, to vet these individuals, to know who they are, to learn their backgrounds. And that complicates the process. They may be exactly who they say they are. They may be repressed
oppressed minorities. They may be legitimate refugees, but how are we to know that? All right, I had a friend that I went through the Special Forces training with. He wasn't a LOGJAC guy because this was in 1988. And he was younger than I by a little bit. But he was Hungarian, and he fled communism at great personal risk, at the risk of imprisonment or death. He escaped Hungary. He escaped communism. He spent over a year in a detention camp in Italy while he applied for asylum with the United States. Spent a year in a refugee camp. Eventually was granted asylum, immigrated to the United States, eventually obtained U.S. citizenship, joined the army, got a clearance, joined Special Forces. This was the whole thing. This is years after the Lodge Act was established, 38 years after. But that system still worked. And he went on to greater things in special mission units, became a pilot. He was a medic. I mean, just a phenomenal individual that contributed greatly to the service of this country and to society. That's the kind of folks we're looking for. Just because you want to get out of a country, some third world crap hole, doesn't give you the inalienable right to become a U.S. citizen. Sorry, it just doesn't work that way. There are processes and procedures that have to be followed. Ideally, we'd establish refugee camps outside of our borders. And these things would be placed under UN or other protection. It's not the United States' problem. It's not that we turn our backs on immigrants. It's not that we wash our hands of that. We have to protect our own borders, and we have to protect our own people from outside threats of radical Islam or other security threats. To not do that would be irresponsible. In fact, we've had 8 years worth of irresponsibility so far, and that's about to change. There's such hysteria and fundamental misunderstanding of what exactly is going on in this country. I have friends, very progressive, and friends on the left that, you know, this morning a friend from high school had sent me a link to a congressman, Democratic congressman, a veteran that was ashamed that Donald Trump was president and ashamed that we have a Muslim ban. And I told her, I said, you know what? I'm ashamed that this guy was elected to Congress if he thinks there's a ban on Muslims, because there's not. And he's an idiot. And he's obviously drank the Kool-Aid and jumped on the fake news bandwagon because, why? Because it fits their agenda. And here's the problem, my friends. It's when you put your politics and your agenda, whether it be open borders or the progressive left, but when you put a political agenda above the national security of the United States, that's a serious problem. And it's irresponsible and it's dangerous. Yet, we see it every day. It fits the narrative that our president is a fascist and is implementing illegal and unconstitutional laws. It couldn't be further from the truth. And unfortunately, the media is playing right into this game and creating more fake news and more sensationalism because they think it's going to improve their failing ratings or it's going to advance their progressive agenda. Again, it's irresponsible and it's dangerous. Now, as far as the criticism coming in from some of our European leaders, makes me chuckle. How dare you tell the United States how to run our country? I think you would be resentful if we told you how to run yours. And by the way, folks, Angela Merkel, I'm sure she's a good-hearted person, albeit an extremely naive one. But you not only compromised the national integrity and security of Germany, but you did it for the European continent, and France, and Holland, and Denmark, and yes, Great Britain. Look at Sweden, and look at the problems now. You know, and I hear them say that, oh, you know, not a single Syrian terrorist had committed an act of violence in the United States. Okay, the big question mark here is yet. Okay, the Swedes could have said, oh, not a single Afghan had committed a rape in Sweden yet. But guess what? It's happened. And it's just a matter whether they come from Syria, whether they come from Turkey, which, by the way, is not on the list. It doesn't matter. The fact is that our borders have to be protected. There is no right for foreigners to enter this country, and we need to know who we're letting in. The gall of leaders of foreign countries to tell the United States what's right and what's wrong after they've screwed their country up irretrievably, not only their countries, but the whole continent of Europe. You can't put that toothpaste back in the tube, folks. The damage has been done.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. It's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. We invite you back to AmericaOutLoud.com to get all the latest. Make it a daily stop and also get the app. You go right to the App Store and download our free app, and that will put all our content right into your hands on your phones and your tablets. It doesn't get any easier than that.
With me today is my friend Sam Freeman from Arizona. Sam and I were in Iraq together. Sam is an Iraqi American who was an interpreter for several years. Sam, thanks so much for coming on the show. I think it's really important to offer listeners an alternative version of interpretation of events with controversial executive order on the temporary immigration ban. You know, you lived the American dream. You experienced that firsthand, and you put back into the system by coming to the aid of this country when it was in need. And I thank you for your service and the years that you spent.
Oh, thank you. The one thing that a lot of people get wrong about refugees is that two things. The people who come in as refugees are people who have been through so much turmoil that they're basically on the verge of, you know, either dying from starvation or being killed in crossfire or rockets or what have you. So the people that come into the United States as refugees are, it's kind of hard to explain, but it's people that have basically almost died and people who have been through so much turmoil and so much chaos. And regardless whether we can prove what elementary they went to or what political affiliation they may have, these are people who have spent at least 2 years and sometimes 4 or 5 years trying to go through processes, trying to get through a clearance processes where they take them to camp, you know, where they can wait until they get to go somewhere. And a lot of people don't understand that the fact that we already have a very strict process. I remember when we came in as refugees, a lot of people were turned down, and some of those people were turned down for maybe mistakes, but a lot of people were still being turned down. So what people who come in as refugees, they're not scooped out of the ground like sand and brought into the United States. People go through a very rigorous, we have 3 different interviews that we went through, and this is, mind you, this is 1992. I know since Al-Qaeda and ISIS have been around, there's been a lot more scrutiny and there's been a lot more questions, and and people who do these interviews have gotten a lot smarter. They can tell who needs refuge and who is trying to make things up. And having said this, you know, people are talking about people who would be terrorists that would infiltrate. A person who's a terrorist is not going to spend 2 years waiting in line to get into the United States. Because usually these people are very volatile, you know, when they go right before they blow themselves up. A lot of times they have their hands handcuffed to a steering wheel, for example, for a suicide bomber. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these people are on, these people are unstable. And oftentimes these people just want to do something that's fast, quick, because who knows if they're going to change their mind. And there, as you know this, Jamie, a lot of people have changed their mind on their way of, you know, you've been in Iraq, you've seen people who were supposed to, but then they just walked away. So the, you know, the notion that, oh, you know, these people are trying to infiltrate. No, no one's going to spend years trying to infiltrate. They usually, you know, they'll usually spend, you know, a month or two or whatever, but they're not going to spend that time and live in a situation and pretend for years just to come to America. So I think that's a really big thing that, you know, maybe people who have never been refugees may not see that.
And another thing is, you didn't come from a background of poverty, not until the refugee status. You came from a fairly affluent family in Baghdad and basically just walked away and left everything.
By all means, and back in the days with Saddam Hussein, if you had any type of influence, if you started becoming a millionaire in Iraqi standards, and let's not forget the Iraqi dinar in the 80s, the Iraqi dinar was equivalent to $3 at its peak, was equivalent to $3.75, average of $3.50, very similar to the Kuwaiti dinar. And now the Iraqi dinar is worth 1/2000th of an American dollar. So at the time, we had cars. Every one of my brothers had cars. My brother had just bought a one-year-old vehicle, a Chevy Celebrity, in 1991. That was his own gift for having graduated medical school from Baghdad. And we had just moved into a home that was only built 4 years earlier. So by no means we were poor. It was a political thing. It was, we want to have you. And basically in the days with Saddam, when they take you, when you go in that truck or that whatever, there's a very small chance that you're actually going to come back home or that you're going to make it out alive.
Yeah, I had other friends in Baghdad, Iraqi families of means that, the daughters and the wife had worked for the Coalition Provisional Authority at the time, and I asked the father. I said, "Why don't you?" He said, "Oh, they won't take me. I was a member of the Ba'ath Party." He said, "I had to be. I owned several businesses, and kind of like the Nazi Party in Germany. You know, if you were a fireman or a school teacher or a mailman, you were a member of the Nazi Party, or you were unemployed.
You have to have that oath." Yeah, you have to have the oath and you have to have the affiliation. There are degrees, but you have to have that affiliation with the party.
And he said that he was just thankful that that Saddam just kept nationalizing his businesses and allowed him to go and start another business. You know, he had two beautiful daughters and his wife, and of course there was the concerns. I spent a fair amount of time over there looking for Uday and Kusay, evil creatures that they were. And I mean, he told me very frankly about, you know, life under Saddam and how his businesses were taken over by the government. He just started another business until it was. But yeah, it's hard for Americans to internalize the living in fear. And I think we as a people, as Americans, are warm-hearted, good people. I don't think it's not an anti-Muslim ban. It's not even an anti-refugee ban. It's a temporary, it's 120-day slowdown with seven countries until they get a grip on the immigration policies, which I think have been largely out of control for the past 8 years under the previous administration. So I think the media has sensationalized this and made it into be something greater than what it is. But, you know, at the same time, I've had other other Arabs that are here that are worried. They're worried about being deported. They're worried about you know, to me, I think it's ridiculous. I thought, I said, look, you're a U.S. citizen. You have as many rights as I do, regardless of your heritage. But, you know, they don't understand that. There is a palpable fear among some of the Muslim Americans now. Whether it's real or perceived, I mean, it's real to them. It's a delicate situation, and look at all the problems it's causing.
The way I see it is that obviously there's no one answer. There's no one clear cut answer. My concern is that, you know, when President Trump was, you know, President elect Trump, when he was a candidate, you know, one of the things he said is that, you know, he changes his mind a lot, and they asked him, well, you know, why do you do this? And he said, I just want to keep you guessing. I want to keep people guessing. And unfortunately, it's hard, you know, for people to guess and take a chance when, you know, let's say, you have a family who, you know, with five children, and you have a year's savings or two or a few years savings to be able to spend $10,000 to $15,000 on a vacation to go back to see your parents, to show your kids to your parents, and then on your flight back, you're being told that you cannot enter the United States. Not only are you not able to go to work anymore, but you're also out, you know, these plane tickets for several people, including your own kids, and those are, you know, that's not, you know, for big families, which this has actually happened. Here, this is not something that is, you know, pleasant, and it's not something that is a minor inconvenience. So I'm all for fixing and tweaking the system, because that's just something that's evolution, that's always going to happen. But it's very difficult when you introduce a law, or, you know, you introduce an executive order, and you just do it, and nobody gets a chance to see it. Nobody is trained on how to implement it. Nobody really knows what to do. That is my main concern, is that, okay, you know, what if one and two match, but not three? So you kind of have to train. You know this better than I do. When you issue an order or like an SOP, people have to know how to use it. People have to be trained. At the airport, immigration has to know what is going on. What is this? What am I looking at?
Yeah, and
you cannot do it overnight and expect people to automatically look at it and say, oh, this is what needs to be done. And not only that, people, you know, when anything like this happens, people kind of need to know this is how we're going to do things. This is what we're introducing, and it needs to be vetted. And he didn't have it. He didn't have it vetted, and that was the issue. Now that's why he's running into all these legalities, because, you know, people from, you know, ACLU just got millions of dollars over, you know, a few days.
Yeah, it was great for them
to fight this. and the way it was presented, it was written in a way that it can be challenged, and it will be challenged, because it goes against the very basis of, you know, of the Constitution. So that's really my concern, is that if you're going to do something and you want to make it great, that's fine. But you need to have the system, you know, vetted. You need to have it adjusted so that when people use it, people know what's going on. People don't like uncertainty. And also, Jamie, one last thing about this is that uncertainty is the nightmare of businesses.
Oh yeah,
have a lot of tech executives. You have a lot of people that want to plan for years ahead, and we get a lot of, like it or not, we get a lot of foreign talent. And what makes America just this beautiful, you know, superpower is that we handpick people from all over the world to come to America to work on specific projects, to work on technology, to create things, to patent, to manage talents. And now all of a sudden, people don't want to come, because a person who has dignity, a person who is, you know, a top-notch person in his community, in his society, is not going to take a risk and be detained and suffer at an airport possibly for days and want to be turned around. They'd rather not take that gig. So that's where it's going to hurt, is the economy.
I think a lot of this was
kind of a self-inflicted wound, and I agree with what you're saying. The rollout was terrible. I understand, the need for discretion and secrecy, but even his own secretaries and the DHS, they were caught off guard and they reacted. It was not a proactive plan. You got people that fell into this limbo, the ones that were in transit and had valid visas, that was a problem. Green card holders, that was a problem. You and I are apart politically, but I'm willing to stipulate there were a lot of problems with the way this executive order was rolled out, things that could have been avoided. When you and I first talked, I had first heard about an interpreter that was detained at the airport. I've talked about this before, that, we did this as far back as the Lodge Act after World War II. Let's create a pathway to citizenship, an expedited pathway for people such as, you were an American citizen that went over there, but, similarly, we had Iraqi citizens that were Cat 1s, foreign nationals, that worked. I've been all over the Balkans, Gulf.
A lot of people. Yeah, a lot of, Jamie, if you remember, between 2000 and 2003, when we started working, everybody got to go home. All the local nationals got to go home after work. But in 2004, after the ex-Baathists started grouping and they basically became Al-Qaeda. In 2004, local nationals were getting picked off every single day. 50, 80 local national interpreters would be killed at the gates right before they come in. And that's when, there was a lot of talk about, special visa and so on. So still to this day, a lot of these local nationals, when they go to work for the Americans, it's one of two things. Obviously, they want to earn a living, but also more importantly, they can still earn a living somewhere else. What they're doing is that they're helping out Americans against a lot of people in their own community. So these people are risking death every single day when they go to work. So if they are going to be denied a visa, or if they're going to think that there's a chance that they won't be able to do a visa, they will refuse. And this is going on right now in Mosul. Interpreters also get killed. And in Mosul right now, we have a big operation going on. We have hundreds of Americans, and we need those interpreters. If the interpreters stop coming, what value is it? What value is it to them that they could be killed? And by the way, when the job is done, we're just going to leave you here. You're not going to go anywhere. And even though your house is gone and you don't have a place to go to and you're under a threat and there's probably a good chance that you're going to get killed, where are these people going to go to? So that's something that needs to be cleared. That's something that's very, very important for us, for Americans, for the safety of American soldiers who need to have an interpreter, because it's not easy to find an interpreter, as you know.
Right. And so, the U.S. has a poor track record, with the Kurds particularly, and I'll say there were at least two administrations that kind of left the Kurds hanging out there to dry when Saddam was still in power the first time after Gulf One. And I thought, these people should have a separate immigration status higher than your normal refugees. Now, I'm all for tightening controls and making sure that we know who we're bringing in. The problem is that a lot of the countries, because of the political turmoil in Libya, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, it's basically a failed government, and either they don't have the records were never maintained, or we don't have access because of politics and adversity. And I get that. I understand that.
But Jamie, wait a second. The reason they're refugees is because of that, because they have a messed up system, because they don't have a government. If they had a functioning government, Jamie, they would not be refugees. You know what I mean? So
right.
having missing documents, as we did, is not, you know, and that's why they have camps for refugees where they wait like we did to get vetted, to get to know them, to kind of see how they're going to be. And that's the time that they spend kind of processing them back and forth. And not only that, there is a thing called human, you know, human sources. So in a lot of those places, they use the people. If somebody that people don't know, you know, so one of the things that they ask you, was, you know, when you interview for, you know, the refugee program, they'll ask you who you know around here. And if that person does not know anybody or people can't vouch for him, you know, that person is not from this city, is not from this community. And that's a, you know, that would be a good flag. You'd know, oh, well, you know, this person doesn't belong here. He's probably not from this city. So, you know, that's my only comment in terms of not having records. It's hard to get records when your country is, you know, is in turmoil. And sometimes they burn. Sometimes they, you know, they, mm-hmm. they lose them. Sometimes they don't exist. So,
well,
sorry to cut you off.
No. I'm hoping that I think we've swung too far one way, and now I think maybe we're swinging too far the other way, and I hope that we'll find our way back onto middle ground. I hope that we'll have a well-thought and workable policy on refugees. I had a friend that spent a lot of time in northern Iraq and Syria. She's a journalist. I've had her on the show. Mm-hmm. She spent a lot of time with the Yazidis. And, you know, it's the Muslims have been a victim of ISIS more so than the minorities, just because of demographics. There are more Muslims, mm-hmm. certainly, than there are Christians, Jews, or Yazidis in that area. I lived with the Kurds. I spent the better part of a year living in refugee camps along the northern Iraqi border. So I hope that we will have, you know, and that's what America is built on. Back to some of the principles of the Lodge Act, you know, which was created back in the 1950s. In fact, I think it was 1950 to bring. Now, that was intended primarily for Eastern Europe, but the point was to bring in these heritage speakers that had not only the language but the familiarity with the customs, the culture, the terrain, the politics, you know, that were experts in these areas that they came from. And we fast-tracked them through military service. They had an accelerated path to citizenship. It was a great opportunity for them as individuals. It was a great opportunity to have this talent and experience and knowledge. And I think it worked out for everybody's benefit. And of course, you know, they were vetted. We knew who they were, but there were challenges also. Some of them came from Eastern Bloc countries that, you know, were behind the Iron Curtain. And we had similar challenges there as far as, you know, the vetting process. But I think America tends to even itself out. We wander left, we wander right, but somehow we managed to come back to the middle. And, you know, a lot of this stuff gets lost in rhetoric, I think. But, you know, and that's dangerous too. And that goes on both sides as well. Like you said, you know, when the president comes out, or president-elect at the time, and says we're going to have a ban on Muslims, and now it's the appearance is that it is a ban on Muslims. That's how it's perceived. But I wanted to get your perspective, Sam, as an American citizen, as somebody that went through that immigration process. And I think it's important for, you know, you had talked about your mom, you know, and people have a hard time getting past the hijab. That's the first thing they see, and then it stops.
Yes, that's very true. That's very true. I noticed a while back, maybe about a month ago, Target had you know, in their weekly circulars, they had a picture of a woman, you know, an American, you know, an American looking, American seemingly woman on a Target catalog. And people lost their damn mind. Why? Because it was an American, because we're not used to seeing them. In America, unfortunately, you know, we see every, you know, we say that we accept everybody. But the minute you see somebody in, you know, a scarf in, you know, in mainstream, then people start losing it. And that is dangerous because it needs to be normalized. It needs to be normal. A person who wears a turban or a scarf should not be looked at differently, should not be, you know, looked at like they don't speak English. Just like if you have any Asian friends, you know, they get that "where are you from" kind of look because mm-hmm. they can't change the way they look, right? You can take off the scarf and not look like a Muslim, but you can't change your face. And that's a very similar thing. I have, you know, my family is, you know, is a moderate, but moderate has a lot of different definitions. In America, you know, I have two sisters. Neither of them cover their head, but one of my brother's wives covers, and his daughter covers. So I have, you know, one of my nieces, she's 16, you know, and she wears the scarf. She's an American. She's born in America. She is, you know, and you know, when she was in 10th grade, she was class president. She was on the student budget, very social, will make a friend in a heartbeat. But still, I worry if, you know, when we travel, when we go places, I'll be honest with you. For me, it would be troubling to go in middle America with a family, with my mom, with a family that wears a scarf, because I don't know it, because I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if somebody's going to try to assault them, if somebody's going to try to make their day bad, you know. So if I was going on vacation, I would steer clear of some cities that I know are going to be very, you know, the Bible Belt states. I would love to visit, and, you know, and I wouldn't be able to see it with the family. And if I was to marry somebody who wears the scarf, then that would definitely be a concern in terms of perception. And that is a very, very important and very, you know, and very serious matter. So I encourage everybody and anybody who sees anybody being talked down to, or anybody being, you know, threatened or treated in a negative manner, to, you know, to stand up for what's right, and, you know, and just, you know, and just basically, you know, let the person be who they are. If they cover, that is for them. That is a religious requirement. And that's who they want, you know, that's who they choose to be. I remember in the days of September 11th, I live in a suburb in Phoenix. And I remember prior to September 11th, you know, my mom, she came at a very old age to the United States. So she speaks English. She can still communicate, but she does not, you know, she does not have the confidence, and she always needs me to be around. So a lot of times I could go to like Home Depot or Target, and I try to keep some kind of distance from her, but I have my eyes on her. And that's a habit for me, to just kind of see if she needs something, really does need something, then she'll turn around and call me, because it's important. Otherwise she can kind of make it happen with, you know, what, you know, she could communicate. And what I noticed after, you know, post September 11th, we've had about 50 incidents in the city of Phoenix and surrounding area, incidents of attack against Muslims. And I noticed that people would kind of like look and notice her, and being in a service, being in an area where, you know, the average home is $350,000. You're not going to have people who are just going to go out of their way and say something to her. But had we been in a poorer area and, you know, and closer to the city, then that would definitely be, for me, that would be a concern. And so that, you know, that's something that I noticed. There was a change. There was always a change. Sad that I have to be discriminatory for the well-being of my family. And I would hate to see that. That's something that I'd hate to see.
It is. And, you know, you were saying that, you know, some of the girls, it's their choice. And at least here, they have that choice. They don't have, I've seen
women have their calves whipped or their ankles whipped in Afghanistan because their burqas were not quite long enough. But it is a choice. And, you know, that's part of the freedoms that this country offers. And I just hope that everybody is cognizant of those freedoms. That's what kind of distinguishes us as Americans. So it's a delicate balance of providing for our national security and taking necessary precautions, but at the same time, keeping your heart open and your mind open. The fact that we all don't look alike, we all don't talk alike, we all pray to different gods, but bottom line is we're still Americans.
We pray to the same God, Jamie. We just pray a little bit differently.
Right, right. Sam, thanks so much for coming on. You know, as I get into some of these discussions, I think it's really important that you know the listeners kind of look at things from a different perspective and a different take on it. And you know, I can't relate to that. I never went through the same things that you did, but. Again, I'd like to thank you for what you did for this country, and thanks for coming on the show with me today, Sam.
And I thank you, especially because I know you have a different perspective politically.
Yeah, and I'm politically, but that's what makes America great.
Yeah, but exactly, and that's my point is that I'm especially thankful that you're able to bring somebody who has a different kind of perspective to show that. We no matter how far apart we are, we're still friends, and we can still talk about things and discuss things in a civil manner, and not be trolling on social media and not being hurtful and resentful. And at the end of the day, America will go home, and everybody gets to have their happy meal, and everything eventually gets better because we have that system of balances, which I am very thankful for.
Me
too. So I thank you, Jamie. I appreciate you bringing me on here.
Anytime, Sam, and I'll definitely give you a shout next time I get out to Phoenix.